Blighty Thank God is based on the diary our family discovered my late father, Ron Chapman, wrote in 1943 when he was a young RAF pilot serving in the Middle East and Italy.
In this grave hour,
I'm Neil Chapman and a former journalist. The podcast highlights the stories I uncovered when I researched his diary along with other historical sources. World War II posters were famous for urging everyone to do their bit for victory. Dig for victory, keep calm and carry on, or make do and mend. One poster from around 1942 urges, "Don't keep a diary. It might get into the enemy's hands." No doubt historians are grateful that the likes of Prime Minister Churchill and other senior leaders thought the directive didn't apply to them. But then it was ever thus. I'm not quite sure why my father, Flight Sergeant Ron Chapman, an ordinary RAF pilot, also chose to ignore it. As far as my family knows, he hadn't kept a diary before 1943. And we don't know of any diaries afterwards. He never spoke of one, even the one he wrote for 1943. It was 30 years after he died that we actually found it among my late mother's effects. But I'm glad he did write one. It's as if my brothers and I hear his voice again. And it reminds us of the person he was. He was a major influence on who we became, even though we lost him quite early on in our lives. But that's on a personal level. I believe my father's diary has wider significance. He was one of the thousands of reluctant warriors in World War II. They were forced to interrupt their lives, be away from family, and face dangers it's hard for us to imagine today. His thoughts and feelings and how he got through the ordeals, put up with the irritations of military life, must surely be reflected in what so many others went through. From his first entries and throughout the diary, it's clear sudden death lurked like a ghost every day, whoever you were, as this episode illustrates. On New Year's Day 1943, Flight Sergeant Ron Chapman from St. Albans Hearts was in Iraq, aged 22 years old, when he picked up his pen to start writing a diary. He'd joined the RAF in the UK in November 1940. He'd started his pilot training about 6 months later. After earning his wings and learning how to fly different planes, he was posted to West Africa in December 1941. During his first year overseas, from the end of 1941 to the beginning of 1943, he had probably caught malaria already. He had survived his first plane crash and also seen a close friend he had trained with killed. He was in Iraq after recently joining RAF communications flight, based at RAF Habaniya, just north of Baghdad, and the major British military location in the country during World War II. While it was a comfortable location, with swimming pools, cinemas and sports pitches and tree-lined streets, joining and fitting into a new unit could be challenging, as grandson David reveals.
January the 1st, 1943. I hear that I may go with Clifton down the Gulf for about a week. We'll see if Flight Lieutenant Shand lets me go. Sunday, January the 3rd. I'm getting all the shitty little jobs. Unless one is in the little clique here, one gets all the dirty jobs.
Communications flight, and my father, was now part of the British command called PAY Force, Persia and Iraq Force. They were charged with defending British interests in Persia, now Iran, and Iraq. Britain had vital war interests in both countries. These included oil fields and pipelines in the north, mainly, as well as a huge fuel refinery in Basra in the south, all vital for the war effort. Now, in 1941, Iraqi rebels laid siege to RAF Habaniya as they tried to kick the British out. They were unsuccessful. In 1943, these assets were still under threat from the Germans. If they could defeat the Russians at Stalingrad in the north and then push on southwards, they would be able to attack and possibly claim these assets and use them against the Allies. In charge of the RAF in the Middle East was Arthur Tedder. On January the 4th, the day after my father complained about being given shitty jobs, Arthur Tedder witnessed the death of his wife, Rosalind, when the plane she was in crashed as it was coming into land at Cairo during a sandstorm. And just 2 years earlier, the couple had lost their son, a pilot. Yet it says something about the incredible commitment of someone like Tedder that 2 weeks after his wife was killed, he was at the famous Casablanca conference, where it was agreed that the Allies would only accept unconditional surrender from Germany and Japan. Death and danger were close to everyone fighting the war.
Tuesday, January the 12th. Squadron leader Milnes called me in to see my logbook. And when he heard I'd flown Marylands, he murmured that if he'd known, it would have made a lot of difference. Letter card from Mum. Dad was canned Christmas Day. Monday, January the 18th. Here Milnes had left Tehran with lots of bigwigs aboard, but had to return owing to wireless trouble. No news of Milnes. He hasn't reached Tehran and was only 26 minutes out, but bad weather up that way. Milnes definitely lost.
33-year-old George Milnes was with the Royal New Zealand Air Force. From Christchurch, he was a university graduate with a Bachelor of Science. The Maryland was a bomber my father had flown twice during his training in 1941. The significance of why he was being asked about it isn't explained in the diary. Milnes took off from Tehran for RAF Habaniya on Monday, January the 18th, in a Hudson aircraft, EW-969. On board were five crew and six passengers.
Tuesday, January the 19th. No news of Milnes. Two Hudsons standing by, but snow, fog, etc. towards Tehran. Shand and Stacey lost for a bit, but they got back to Baghdad. Hope we find Milnes okay. If anything has happened to Milnes, it will be enough to start a war. His reputed list of passengers is Shah, as in Shah of Persia, Commander-in-Chief Persia, Commander-in-Chief Iraqi Air Force, some of their families, and a load of other bigwigs.
My father mentions that the Shah of Iran could have been on board the aircraft. In 1941, the British and Russians had invaded Iran and forced the abdication of the Shah's father. They installed the son, Mohammed, who was in his 20s. It's because the father had ignored warnings from the British and Russians to expel Germans still in Iran after Hitler had invaded Russia. Despite the bad weather, a major search was underway looking for Milnes's plane, the crew, and passengers.
Wednesday, January the 20th. Very foggy. Went down flight to stand by for search. Report that an aircraft was over Kernishah flying west, so we were to search that area if weather clear. Then another report that an aircraft was heard about 15 miles from Qam, and a very cartridge was seen presumably fired from ground. We are to search from Habaniya to Frontier. Bloody stupid, I think.
And the next day, on January the 21st, my father flew a Hudson aircraft, the same type that they were looking for, to search in the area of the border between Iraq and Iran. Looking at a map and plotting the flight path between Habaniya and Tehran and the various sightings that are mentioned in the diary, it's not hard to agree with my father that where he was sent to search, they were unlikely to be successful. but only a short time after reaching their target area, they were recalled to find out that an aircraft had been found southwest of Tehran. The search had involved many other planes, including Hurricanes from 74 Squadron based at Tehran Airport. While my father knew few details of what had happened, he was sure there was more to the incident than met the eye.
Monday, January the 25th. Here Milnes's kite has been found, but all bodies unrecognisable. Must have gone straight in. I hear that Shah decided not to travel. Maybe right. If so, he was bloody lucky.
In fact, after 6 days being missing, the aircraft wreckage and 11 bodies were found by members of the Persian cavalry in the mountains about 180 miles southwest of Tehran. The plane had been less than halfway through its flight when it had crashed. The bodies of Squadron Leader Milnes, along with the four other RAF crew, were recovered and buried at Tehran War Cemetery on January the 27th. Members of 74 Squadron provided the pallbearers, as well as a firing and escort party. Among the British passengers was an army captain and the director of the Public Relations Bureau in Tehran. The Iranian passengers were all senior military, including a general and two colonels. The Shah had not been on board as my father had thought at first. The plane's wireless operator, Stanley Gatley, from Hull in Chester, was just 23 years old, the same age as my father when he celebrated his birthday on January the 21st.
Thursday, January the 21st. I got stinking drunk and don't remember from 10 p.m. onwards. I wish I knew how I got to bed. Flight Lieutenant Shand let me off flying in the morning when I said I was getting tight.
At the start of 1943, the war's end must have seemed a long way off. My father's diary entry for his birthday could have been written by many young men in the military at the time. Drinking was how people socialised, especially in the military. What is different is that the diary highlights individual tragedies that happened well away from the fighting front. There was a war on. You kept going. You never knew what tomorrow might bring. To find maps, photographs, and other material associated with each episode, as well as the complete diary with my research notes, visit the website blightythankgod.co.uk. The diary extracts are read by Ron Chapman's eight grandchildren. He'd be proud of all of them.